Okay, so I don't have a Bible in front of me, but I have the verses written down right here. So let me just read these three verses, because these three verses are going to guide us. And this is part two of the image of God. Last week we talked about the image of God in the individual. Now we're going to expand that and see the image of God in community. So, three verses from Genesis. Genesis 1:28. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So the key there is, be fruitful and multiply. Multiply what? Image bearers. Okay, Genesis 2:18. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." So two things there. Not good that the individual is alone. That's not just about man and woman, but I think we're going to see that's the case in general. And then a helper fit for him. So you can see there's implied that there's a task. Okay, so that's the second thing. Genesis 9:5-6. Fast forward your fingers to Genesis 9:5-6. This is the covenant that God makes with Noah. We'll come back to it, treat it in detail, but this is what it says. "From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. For whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image." So, where we're going today is parts 3 and 4, sections 3 and 4 of my original outline, the image of God, but I had to divide it into two parts. And so, the third point is our first point today. The image of God in the collective is family, education, and labor. We're going to see that that is a social expression of life, liberty, and property. And then we're going to fast forward to Genesis 9, and we'll see how just force comes in and why it comes in. The just use of force is added in reference to the image of God. Okay, so the big idea this week is the same as last week. Human beings were made to do everything that we do because of what it says about God. So all we're going to do here is we're going to blow it up from individual to a society. That says something about God too. It's going to say something more specific about God. And the hint, hint, hint is the form of the picture. You see three. Okay? Well, you'll see that. So let's do a little bit of review from last week. We didn't get to finish, and there were two quotes in particular that I think, if I read them, I think they'll maybe jog your memory from last week and set us up pretty well for this week too. I have a chart there that I had in the notes last week. I put it in the notes again. This time you see life flowing to the right to family, liberty flowing to the right to education, and property flowing to the right to labor. What that chart stands for is the individual faculty in the soul. And then flowing to the right, you're going to see the collective expression of that same thing. How that thing plays out. How that thing is maintained. So God has covenanted and obligated both the individual and the institutions. This is what libertarianism is utterly ignorant of. The libertarian worldview does not believe this. The libertarian worldview comes from the Enlightenment and sees the individual, and that's right, but they don't see the institution. And God has covenanted and therefore obligated both. And this is going to imply that the constituent elements of the individual are extended to the constituent elements of the collection of individuals. In other words, both the individual and a collection of individuals are God's making. God made both the individual and marriage, for example. God made both. They are both things with natures. And if you don't reckon with that, your political theory is irrational and does not correspond to the real world. So, let's read this quote by Frederick Bastiat. I was given this little pamphlet called The Law in 1997 when I joined the Libertarian Party. A couple of us sat down, had a beer. I was 21. The guy gave me some books by Bastiat and Friedrich A. Hayek. If you're a libertarian, you know who those guys are. If you're a conservative, you know who those guys are. Bastiat's book is really good. I've recommended it to people. But he kind of leaves you hanging. Let me read the quote, and you'll recognize something that we believe in. But there's a limitation to it. It begs some questions. Here's what he says. At the very beginning, first two pages of the law. It was written in 1850, strangely enough, 2 years after the Communist Manifesto, right in the middle of all that stuff going down. Bastiat says, life, liberty, and property. This is man. I agree. And in spite of the cunning of artful political leaders, these three gifts from God precede all human legislation and are superior to it. Life, liberty, and property do not exist because men have made laws. On the contrary, it was the fact that life, liberty, and property existed beforehand that caused men to make laws in the first place. What then is law? It is the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense. That's true secondarily. Sorry, my little parentheses. If every person has the right to defend, even by force, his person, his liberty, and his property, then it follows that a group of men have the right to organize and support a common force to protect these rights constantly. Thus, the principle of collective right, its reason for existing, its lawfulness, is based on individual right. Well, got some stuff right there. These three things come from where? Government or God? God gives life, liberty, and property. He's saying the government's going to come afterwards. Because this is true, second premise, we have the right to defend these things, and therefore we have the right to get together and defend if these are really inherent to the man. Well, I agree with that. But there's a way to read him in a very libertarian fashion. So that when he gets to that part in the paragraph that says that if every person has the right to defend even by force, his person, his liberty, and his property, then it follows, here's the second step, that a group of men have the right to organize, and so this verb, organize, support a common force, is that now, okay, I have this right in nature, and therefore, step two, I'm going to get together with other people, and we're going to agree. And based on that agreement, you have the rule of law. What did he just say? Now, I can't read Bastiat's mind. I can't say, for example, hey, where did he get this from? I can tell you where he got it from, Genesis 9, 5, and 6. Well, he may have, but he didn't explicitly say that. We're going to get it from Genesis 9, 5, and 6, but if you don't, you might mean that, yeah, God gives you the rights, not government. You have this, and so government is the creation of us getting together, because we have the right to do that. Wait a minute, you skipped a step there. It's a pretty important step, too. And you've pretty much said that this is a social contract. So on that point, Bastiat would agree with his fellow countryman Jean-Jacques Rousseau a century earlier that talked about the social contract being this thing that emerges from this position where we're just noble savages back there. And we get smarter and so on. I don't know. I can't interview him because he's not here. But here's the practical fallout of this. Whether one likes to face it or not, mere libertarianism leaves one with the dilemma of deifying either the self or the state. You're at this crossroad at the beginning of your political theory, and you say to yourself, I had better exalt myself as sovereign, or else the state will be sovereign. Why? Because the libertarian mind sees all of civic life reduced to a one-dimensional tug-of-war between individual liberty and collective coercion. Virtually nothing else exists. The individual getting together with other individuals, or the state. And this guy, I'll put a hat on him to represent that he's an official. Either I'm sovereign, and so I can check his power, or he's sovereign. And the problem with that is that anytime anybody talks about anything else, such as, you know, you'd better raise your kids to have self-control, because if they don't, the taxpayers are going to, are you saying that the government should mandate what is the good life and what is not? That's all a libertarian hears. Anytime you say, you know, we have a public interest in such and such so that the government doesn't get more power, all they hear is the government, because they've confused God with government. And their only solution is to make us God. Now, they don't use those words, but that's pretty much what's going on. Nothing else exists between, or this tug of war between the individual and the state, the individual and the collective. And so you have a battle between individualism and collectivism. Well, I would suggest a better way. In a much lesser known work, in 1744, called The Essential Rights and Liberties of Protestants, Jonathan Edwards' tutor at Yale, Elisha Williams, would write something very similar to Bastiat. Here's what he says, and he's going to argue this from the Scriptures, and see if you can detect life, liberty, and property, where it comes from, and what it demands of us. He says, quote, "As reason tells us, all are born thus naturally equal." In other words, with an equal right to their persons, so also with an equal right to their preservation. "And therefore to such things as nature affords for their subsistence." So that's another way of saying life, liberty, and property. "For which purpose, God was pleased to make a grant of the earth in common to the children of man, first to Adam, and afterwards to Noah and his sons, as the psalmist says in Psalm 115:16. So he doesn't cite Genesis 9:6. We'll get to that in a second. But Williams goes on, he says, "And although no one has originally a private dominion exclusive of the rest of mankind," that's what the libertarian's mistake is, nobody's ever existed outside of society, outside of covenant. "Although no one has originally a private dominion exclusive of the rest of mankind in the earth, or its products, as they are considered in this their natural state, yet since God has given these things for the use of men and given them reason also to make use thereof, to the best advantage of life, there must of necessity be a means to appropriate them some way or another, before they can be of any use to any particular person. And every man having a property in his own person, the labor of his body and the work of his hands are properly his own." Remember, that word property meant proper to the man, all the way back to the Latin. We looked at that last week. "It will therefore follow that when he removes anything out of the state that nature has provided and left it in, he has mixed his labor with it and joined something to it that is his own, and thereby makes it his property." Remember, 8th commandment, 10th commandment. God said, don't steal. 10th commandment, don't even think about it. It says 7 times, your neighbors, your neighbors, your neighbors, your neighbors, your neighbors, your neighbors, or anything else that is your neighbors. Don't even think about it. "He, having removed it out of the common state of nature, placed it in, it hath by his labor something annexed to it that excludes the common right of others, because this labor being the unquestionable property of the laborer, no man but he can have a right to what that is once joined to, at least where there is enough and as good left in common for others. Thus, every man having a natural right to, or being the proprietor of, his own person and his own actions and labor, and to what he can honestly acquire by his labor, which we call property. It certainly follows that no man can have a right to the person or property of another. And if every man has a right to his person and property, he has also a right to defend them, and a right to all the necessary means of defense, and so has a right of punishing all insults upon his person or property." Insults just means violations there. Don't read that to mean if somebody says something bad about it. That's not what he's saying. Although that is important for fraud and slander and stuff like that, though. Now, notice about this quote. The order is the same as in Bastiat's quote. But the conclusion in William's thought doesn't follow chronologically. In other words, it's not a historical progression. This argument does not depend on there being a noble savage, let's call him Adam or whoever else, at one point, and then he decides to join together. He says, hey, you want to defend this? Because we're weak and we don't like that strong guy. So we get together, pool our resources, and that guy says, hey, that's a great idea. And that's where the right emerges from. This consent. Mutual consent. In other words, what is this thing? It's a contract. Well, is consent important? Yes. Is it a contract of sorts? Yes. But is that how it starts? And what would we lose in the biblical worldview if we started things that way? William's argument, unlike Bastiat's, unlike the libertarian argument, is that God has said, this is what you are, this is what you are together, therefore, Genesis 9, this is what you are to defend. In other words, this is a divine covenant. It's vertical before it's horizontal. And that's going to make all the difference in the world, as we're going to see. So, let's get to this. As we look at this idea of God creating His image as an individual in society, the first place we're going to go today, that was just a little bit of review from last week, the image of God in the collective is family, education, and labor. So we looked at life, liberty, and property last week. Those are the components of the individual. But family, education, and labor are the social expressions of this. First of all, let's get this first idea first, theologically. What does this say about God? We saw how an image of God as an individual said something about God. Does a group of individuals being together, not just in any old way, but the way that God put them together, does that say anything about God? Well, if God did it, God doesn't do anything. God doesn't talk to hear himself talk. He never says nothing. So it must say something. Consider the New Testament law of the same thing. 1 Corinthians 10:31. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. If you vote on Tuesday, is that part of that everything?
Yes.
Yeah. Let me give you an escape hatch and then I'll close it on you. What if you don't vote on Tuesday? Ah, I can get away from that question. No, you don't. It says whatever you do. Will you be doing something when you do something else? You will. You'll be opting out. Are you sure that says the right thing about God? Whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. Translation, do it because it says the exact thing that God says that it says about Him. How am I supposed to know that? Start reading the Bible. It's a lifelong journey. We order ourselves. We order our resources. We order those under our care in the exact way that we do because of what it says about God. But this theological meaning is also good for us. In showing us Himself, God is always being kind to us. Notice in Genesis 1:28, where we started today, that before He gives the four creation mandates to Adam and Eve, He says that God blessed them. That's the heading. God blessed them. Then He said, multiply, cultivate, have dominion, know and name these animals. But the heading was, He blessed them. They're all good things. We can't say, yeah, but man uses them for that. I understand that. That's the fall. That's the distortion. But if we slander the design, we're slandering God. All of this is an act of common grace. And that is the case because community, friendship, creativity, together, cooperation, are all good things. It was God who said in Genesis 2:18, it is not good that man should be alone. Libertarianism says it is very good that man should be alone. Government exists to keep that going. That's false. Now, this is one sense in which Aristotle's very high view of politics is actually correct. Pretty much everything else is wrong. But this is that one sense in which that high view of politics, man is a political animal. Remember, what does that Greek word polis mean? It means city. It means community. Well, man's a social animal. Socialism. Stop. Man is a communal animal. Do you have a family? Are you a communist now? All right. So man is a communal animal. In other words, it's good to be together. It is not good that we should be alone. Now, Aristotle couldn't explain why that was. But in the biblical view, from the beginning, man is made for woman and woman is made for man. And both were made for others still. And there's something about accomplishing a project together that was meant to be good. This thing called society or community says something about God because God has always been in a perfect community, a perfect society in the Trinity. And you'll notice that in all of the institutions, and raise your hand if you've seen the Truth Project, did you notice in all the institutions there was a threeness going on? And not just in it, you couldn't just wonder like one of those old CD thingies, old now, that you switch the deck. It couldn't go like that. There's a head. There's an object. There's subjects. There's all these different things. There's this relationship. And it says something about the Trinity. So, let me define this. What do I mean by social sphere? Let me just define it in the most basic, you know, common dictionary way at first, and then we'll give it a theological definition. A social sphere is at least this much. It is a definite, fixed relationship of persons to each other. Now, the word fixed is going to be important. Who fixed it? But I don't mean fixed like it was broken and I fixed it. I mean, who made it concrete? Who made it exactly the way it is? God did. What we're going to see in the Bible is that God calls these social orders what they are, and He fixes them. He gives them a particular nature. Now, since social spheres are always theological, we have to understand this and ask what it says about God. These are not merely sociological. A social sphere, let me add to that definition now. Let me throw some theology in it. A social sphere is an objective relationship of persons to each other. Got that so far. Which is to represent in the world what is eternally true of God. this is going to help you not feel dirty about some of those relationships anymore. If you feel dirty, it's because of the distortion, not the design. God made these things to say on earth, through human beings, exactly what is true about himself in heaven. And so man is not only an image of God as an individual, but in a greater glory, in a more specifically Trinitarian glory, man is an image of God in community. We could say it like this: the DNA of the social spheres can be seen in Genesis 1 and 2, in all those tasks that are given to Adam and Eve. We're going to see that these spheres are holistic, and this misunderstanding of libertarianism follows from the first. Because they don't see this, they don't see that these are holistic. They're interdependent. So let's draw over here the family. Let's just draw them, and I'll just unpack them like a drawer so you don't get the wrong idea. I'm not trying to say everything here. I'm just trying to say one thing. The field of labor. And eventually in the new creation, the church. But then we get to Genesis 9, 5, and 6, which I promise we will get to. These things are mutually dependent on each other. They were made to support each other. They were not meant to be at war with each other. There's that thing that we're going to talk about if we have time at the end called sphere sovereignty. It's an idea that Abraham Kuyper, the Dutch Reformed theologian, thought of at the end of the 19th century. But it's a pretty important thing. In other words, you can't make these things each other, but you also can't make them have nothing to do with each other. You can't make them each other. That's the problem with collectivism. It erases these boundaries and the almighty state starts to subsume all the others inside of itself. But, against individualism, you cannot separate them and be a Lone Ranger, because you will lose your Lone Ranger status. No man is an island here. If you try to be, all the things that people need your strength for to keep this beast in its cage is going to be eradicated. Libertarianism kills libertarianism. Libertarianism kills liberty. Because you need a bunch of things outside of the individual to keep the monster of the state in its cage. And we'll start to see that. All right. Well, if all dominion meant that the physical subduing of the plant animal kingdoms, if that's all it was, then what do we make of Adam's task of naming the animals in Genesis 2? This is an intellectual dominion. So I'm not going to argue here this week for the family. I'm going to do a whole week on marriage as an institution that God designed a certain way, and that, and here's our burden to prove, especially in court, for Christian lawyers that are coming up through the academy. Pay attention to this. Our burden to show is to contradict that majority opinion in court decisions that marriage as one man and one woman has no rational public interest. In other words, that has nothing to do with the public interest. We want to show that it does. That it's an actual thing with a nature that you need in society. So, we're going to assume that today, and we're going to focus on education and labor today. Okay? Then we'll bring in the state. But there's an intellectual dominion that Adam was engaged in. And I think we mentioned, maybe we didn't, but the word education literally means to lead out of. Maybe we did. But here it is, in the Latin. Ducare. In fact, probably not a whole lot of baseball fans here. We have El Duque, the Yankee pitcher. But what about Benito Mussolini? World War II fans. No, World War II enthusiasts. I don't know. Okay. There was this Italian guy that we tried to kick out eventually, you know, us Italian people. He called himself El Duque. And that meant the leader. So Ducare means to lead. So you put this little thing at the beginning here. And even, that's the word I talked about last week. Liber. So what's a, if that's a will acting like a will, a free will, what do you think this would be? Now, words get really torn out of their context as time goes on. But the idea of a classical education had the connotations that what we're doing is we are liberating, we are leading out this otherwise animal. A child, if left to himself, a sinner, if left to himself, and this is a Christian classical education. The pagan didn't have the sin element. But a Christian had the idea that we have an animal nature. We have a sinful nature, too. And therefore, education is meant to lead us out of that. Okay? It's not much of an education gets into another subject if it doesn't war against the sin nature too. But basically what you're doing is you have nature down here. And the only thing that's going to graduate you from nature, and nature's not bad, don't get that idea. What's going to liberate us from that is this. What's that got to do with the state? Well, does the state, after the fall, if it wants to grow its power, have a vested interest in having you think you are a mere animal or part of the machine? Does the state have an interest in doing that? Does the state have an interest in keeping you down here in chains? Yes. So education throughout Western history was seen as the means by which we can keep this beast in its cage. By raising up a whole society of people who were sharper than their leaders. And their leaders could be their servants. Because everybody was intelligent and morally self-controlled enough to keep the beast in its cage. That is the only purpose for education throughout Western history. Everything else comes from that. And I'll argue that point if you want to later. There's a redemptive way to say that as well. Alright, we'll come back to that. But liberty and learning are connected in the very same way that life and marriage are connected. Listen to the preacher in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 12. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. It's like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. As life, liberty, and property are inseparable, so their social expression preserves them. Proverbs 4:13, keep hold of instruction. Do not let go. Guard her, for she is your life. Now you might be saying about all these. Those things are only addressing our spiritual bondage. And wisdom is raising us to a spiritual freedom from, okay, that's the main connotation. But that is that's a forced interpretation of the scripture to say it has no other connotation. We show throughout the Old Testament that it does. In fact, so we did in Ephesians 6 when we talked about the covenant. We talked about Deuteronomy 6 and Deuteronomy 11 that God gave this mandate to parents in Israel to school their children. Now, you can delegate to tutors, but the administrative responsibility of parents has not gone away in the New Testament. And if you remember, the whole reason that God communicated through Moses to these fathers to take this on is so that you don't get wiped out in the land. And so education, according to God, passed on from parents to children, is so that you don't die. Do you die in the physical world? Was he talking about a physical expelling from the land? He was. Israel got ejected from the land. That was a physical thing in real reality. So we're not denying the spiritual, we're saying they're both true. All right. Then there's the field of labor, over which God says to man to cultivate, or in Genesis 2 language, to work it and to keep it. And by the way, work is before the fall. It's good. The thorns and thistles part, that's the curse part. But work in and of itself is good. So he places us over the natural resources, and both a gracious gift of God, cultivating labor. These are inherently ordered things by God. They still are. Psalm 104:14. This is talking to God, and this is long after the curse. He says, you caused the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate. Why does God order the orders of nature? For man to cultivate long after the fall. And good work does not make the product or the profit an end in itself. We like those. We like products. We like profit. That's going to be good, but those are not an end in itself. For example, the better the work, the greater the social influence. Proverbs 22:29. Do you see a man skillful in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. And I said, well, we don't have kings today. I know, but it's a principle. And the principle in general is still true. Okay, you make yourself valuable as a Christian. Joseph is a great biblical example of that principle. Nehemiah is another. All right, so I'm pointing these out just to introduce them. We're going to talk about them a lot. But I'm pointing these out, giving them shape, just to introduce them. And now we're going to start bringing in the state for a second. But before we do, say one more thing about consent. Because I think one of the main things I want you to see today is that social spheres, groups of people together, because of what they say about God, are just as objective, just as glorifying to God, just as you need to factor them into your politics just as much as you do the individual. This is a covenant of God. You say, well, then I can't talk to people out there because they don't believe that. That is their problem. God has told you exactly the way He has ordered His world. And you're not going to understand politics unless you understand that. So what about this idea of consent? Are we saying this is a covenant, not a contract? This is an obligation to God, has nothing to do with consent. That's not what we said. I didn't say it had nothing to do with consent. But this is secondary. So, what about consent? Well, human beings were created with the freedom of will, such that a moral action is robbed of all of its virtue to the degree that it's not done willingly. If you do something out of fear or by force, it's obviously not as virtuous as if you did it because you wanted to do it. So here, the Enlightenment state of nature theory, I think, has ravished the modern mind more than we often understand. Many people take it as axiomatic. In other words, they just take it as their first principle. It's not even, it's off the table. It's beyond criticizing. It is just true. It's self-evident that the fundamental feature of a social order is the degree of individual consent that went into it. And that is going to be at the heart of the debate over same-sex marriage, by the way. What makes it what it is this consent. Same thing in the state. What makes that what it is, do you see that in common with everything the libertarian says about both marriage and the state? What makes it what it is consent. Well, as long as they consent, the Germans consented in several different elections to Adolf Hitler. As long as, well, that's an extreme example. Wait a minute, what's the principle? Where do you draw the line? Once it gets really bad, maybe the principle's bad. Taken consistently, this would not simply lead to anarchy. Such a principle is anarchy. If there are any heads, the libertarian thinks, if there is any such thing as an authority in an institution, well, then it's just a necessary evil. Maybe it's somewhat incidental. Maybe it's dispensable. So the libertarian mind will admit heads, but like a monarchy in a monarchical age, it was just a circumstance. It is not the order of things. The order of things begins and ends with the individual. Well, against this Enlightenment isolation of consent, the Bible treats social orders as divine covenants first and human compacts second. We are not saying they are divine covenants, not human contracts. We are saying that they are divine covenants first and therefore human contracts. We're not saying that it's obligation to God, not consent. We're saying it's obligation to God first, consent second. We're not eradicating this by upholding the vertical. We're saying the vertical comes first, or you're not dealing with the same object anymore. What would you lose? Why does this matter? Because if man created this, man can uncreate it. If man decides by getting together, well, this is what works. Well, that's maybe what worked in the 18th century, but maybe it doesn't work so much anymore. Do you see here? This is at the root of the progressivist idea of constitutional law, as opposed to the originalist. In other words, I'm not after what the document says in terms of the original intent of the founders. I'm looking at a living, breathing document. And I have to depend on the wisdom of each subsequent generation to tell us how much we've grown. So what happens there is that everything's up for grabs. Absolutely nothing is in the fixed order of things. So, we would maintain that individual man is a special creation of God, and that social spheres are a special creation of God. That doesn't mean that they may not evolve in some micro sense. So think of evolution for a second. Just as biological organisms may adapt within their own kind, so social organization may develop over time. But it's always going to be a shuffling of the same deck of information. In other words, we can come up with laws, we can apply laws given our unique circumstances in history, but at the end of the day, we cannot go outside of what God says the state is, what God says labor is, and the family is, and so on. Yep. Yeah. Right. Yeah, the consent definitely does. We would say that there is a fixed element of this, that consent is important, and if consent is important, then it's always important.
Well, I'm not saying that it,
right.
It shouldn't stay constant. I'm
right. But our performance in it
right.
is always shifting.
And then we change the definition of consent.
Yeah. Yeah. If you start here, the ultimate form of government is self-evidently democracy. Because whatever the people say is what's true. And so if you look in Nazi Germany, you could say, well, X amount of people voted for Hitler. If you looked in the South, you could say X amount of people voted to uphold slavery or any number of things. That doesn't make it right. We can all see that. But where does that idea come from? It assumes this first. That this is ultimate. Yeah. All right, so the necessary condition of consent in obedience to God in a covenant is not to be confused as a sufficient condition for the legitimacy of a covenant. We like this. We want this. We want the people to have as much political freedom as possible over against the state. But we don't start there, which is why the Founding Fathers and every good philosopher and theologian throughout history believe that democracy was dangerous and demonic. We don't have a democracy, right? We have a representative republic. Because the Founding Fathers, even the deists, were more Calvinistic than we are. They understood that people were evil. Exactly, people are evil. Then stop. So this is the assembly talking. Exactly, people are evil. Keep that guy over there. And what's that saying that... Well, Mel Gibson said in his character in The Patriot, but it was a famous thing they got it from when he was at first being a coward, and I'm against him being a coward at this point, but his rationale was a famous principle. Well, which should I choose? Should I choose one tyrant 3,000 miles away or 30,000 tyrants 1 mile away? Okay? So the Founding Fathers were against this kind of tyranny and this kind of tyranny. Not only is the king evil, but the people are evil. And because the people are evil, the people's evil cannot wait to jump into the wolf's mouth for a little bit of peace, a little bit of prosperity, a little bit of something to give some of their freedom away. Okay? We'll get back. So how has the Republic solved that problem? Well, we'll get to that in a future week. But just see that right away, that this cannot be our starting point. Because then if 80% of the people say, well, let's just kill everybody. Well, that's what we voted for. Yep.
So can we see that in Scripture, the libertarian idea?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Judges is saying everybody did what was right in his own mind, and clearly that scripture is treating it as a bad thing. And then in 1 Samuel 8, which we're going to get to, because that when we get to forms of government, you're going to see something in that text that you've probably never seen before. A couple things that you've probably never seen before in 1 Samuel 8. And you're like, wow, the Bible is not neutral as to form of government. We'll come back to that. I'm looking forward to getting to that. But I can't even get to Calhoun. He kind of he was a mixed bag here. I'll skip him. So here's my principle. Before we get to the state, let me throw a little phrase at you. I don't have it in the grammar, but I think it's important. So what do we believe came first then? The individual? And then he compacted together. So if the individual is going to be sovereign over the state, the individual has to come first, right? Or does society have to come first? Well, no doubt, in the biblical narrative, these three came before this, and that's all you have to affirm. But to say that the individual was created outside of society or outside of covenant is an unbiblical worldview. So here's the phrase I'm going to introduce. We believe that there was a simultaneous creation of the individual as the image of God and the community as the image of God. Now, Genesis 2 and 1 pulls them apart for a second, but you'll notice in verse 26 and 27 that he created the male and female together. Chapter 2 gives you the anthropological version of creation, of day 6. And he separates it. In other words, in the narrative, he's giving you a freeze frame. He said, now, that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Adam really did name the animals. There really wasn't a lapse of time. In Genesis 1, it doesn't give you that elapse of time. In Genesis 2, it gives you the elapse of time to show you something. To show you that it would not be good for man to be alone, which is why God never did any such thing. God created man and woman together in community to multiply. And Eve says it in chapter 1. Why am I doing this? To multiply. Adam was not an end in himself. He was meant to multiply and exercise dominion in community. In his 1978 infamous address at Harvard University where all the liberals said, let's get a Russian here to criticize Western civilization. We'll love him. They loved him for it, right? Well, he said a bunch of things that they didn't like too much. But I think libertarians didn't like the speech much either. He attacked both individualism in the West, the way it was being thought of, and collectivism. Solzhenitsyn, by the way, is a better Russian dissident to listen to than Ayn Rand. But Solzhenitsyn said, among other things, quote, "The defense of individual rights has reached such extremes as to make society as a whole defenseless against certain individuals. It is time in the West to defend not so much human rights as human obligations." So the government's going to get to decide. He'd said nothing of the sort. A libertarian sees government and he sees God in the mirror. And he says, I better be God or he's going to be God. Wrong. If you erode this or this or this, you will have no defense against this. You need this, like Solomon said about all his work. Who knows if I'm going to give this to my sons and they're going to be a bunch of fruit loops. That's in Ecclesiastes. That's the Message version. But it's exactly what he said. He's saying, you can work all day. You can be Mr. Libertarian, Mr. Self-Sufficient. You can be Robinson Crusoe. You can build all these things. You can be John Galt. And if you don't have kids who can control themselves, you're going to lose it all eventually anyway. It's not real. That's what Solzhenitsyn's point is. But anytime we say, you know, there's other things that exist besides the individual and the collective, all the libertarian hears is, so who gets to decide what's right? That is so simple-minded, it is not even worthy of any response. So out of that collision course between these two ideas in the modern West, we have individualism and we have collectivism. What does individualism do? Well, it inflates a truth, the superiority of the individual over the collective. Have we not just seen in Bastiat's quote and Williams' quote, as we're going to see in Genesis 9:6, is the individual superior to the state in a sense? Yes! I'll paraphrase C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. He says, civilization is for a moment, but the individual soul is forever. There's a sense in which the individual is superior to the state. Individualism takes a perfectly true truth and inflates it into psychosis. Now, what does collectivism do? Collectivism inflates the superiority of the collective over the individual. What did we just say from Genesis 1 and 2? And all of the Founding Fathers' statements that we had better be a moral and intelligent people so that we can keep that beast in the cage, we have to do that together or it won't get done. Which is why no libertarian has ever stopped governmental power. Because their philosophy won't allow you to do it together. They're both right about something, but they blow it out of proportion. Both individualism and collectivism commit the fallacy of composition. It's the part-to-whole fallacy. That's true. So you say, if it's true about the part, it's true about the whole. It's called the fallacy of composition. Individualism and collectivism are simple-minded worldviews for simple-minded people that want to do something about something really quick, and they read two books that don't have pictures in them, got all excited, and boom. They're not whole worldviews. All right, let's fast forward to Genesis 9, or we're never going to get through this. The just use of force is added in reference to the image of God. Listen to this about Genesis 9, just as a little introduction. God's covenanting with Noah. It's a covenant of creation because God's reaffirming all that he did in the beginning. God is not going to entertain the idea that this thing was his mistake and therefore the flood. Not at all. But it's a second creational covenant. Because God had essentially judged the world in destroying all of its population. And so, what was God doing? He was starting over with the whole human race in Noah and his generations, which is why he says in the covenant, you and all your generations. So everything he says, this is for you and all your generations. So quick trivia question, who's he speaking to? Everyone. You. Me. What about the pagan? He doesn't know about the story. A, he does know about the story in his tradition. B, doesn't matter. God has covenanted, and that's why it was so evil that his parents didn't tell him. Now, somebody could object to this from chapter 8 on the sacrifice. Now, this whole thing is just pointing to salvation, which it is. They could object that he's going to preserve the earth for the purpose of carrying out his redemptive purpose for mankind. True, but the command to multiply and fill the earth is still repeated in verse 1. So he's going to re-articulate the original creation covenant to Noah and his sons. Now, one of the central items of that covenant was the mandate to defend life. If anyone commits a murder, the punishment would fit the crime. And it's going to be a theological fitting of the crime. So if you look at that, Genesis 9, 5, and 6, notice the reasoning and see how it's rooted back in the original design from Genesis 1. He says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. The word for means because. Okay. Now, notice God says, I will require reckoning. See that up here? I, God speaking, I will require reckoning. What is this? God's covenant. It's not a contract. He doesn't say, here's my advice. If you want to do this together, you can require. No, he says, I require a reckoning. If you take out an image of God, you've attacked the image of God, and therefore you have to be destroyed. And I'm commanding a group of men to do this. And so consequently, the ultimate reason that there is a just use of collective force is because there's an unjust violation of force upon the divine image. When the scriptures go on to teach that God has ordained the state to fulfill this function, you see that most clearly in Romans 13, we can know that the civil root of it, the collective imperative behind it, in other words, the command to a group of people, had already been given long before there was a state in Genesis 9. Adam was a man before there was a state. Noah and his sons were told to do this before any state after them ever did it. So we can see how irrational it would be for any Christian to object that Genesis 1, Genesis 9, that gives us no clear mandate for the state. He's just talking to a group of people way back there. It's got nothing to do with anything. That's wrong. God gives the reason before he gives the structure. This is part of a bigger quote that I had before in a larger writing from Samuel Rutherford in his book, Lex Rex. He's a Puritan guy, and he's basically breaking down this same idea, but you can read that for your own. But let me direct your attention to this chart. See that chart right there? So I have what I'm trying to connect last week and this week in this chart. I have God and then flowing down to man, and that first circle in the middle is the home. So these circles represent these social spheres that came first. The family, education, and labor. Now, they're in embryonic form. Don't say Genesis 2 doesn't use the word education. I know that. I know that. We'll look at the rest of the Bible to see what that meant back in Genesis 1 and 2. So you've got to put the whole Bible together. Okay? That's what we're doing. That's why we're doing a class like this. So that first circle is home. And then you have education that corresponds to liberty. And then you have labor that corresponds to property. You see those shields there? That's where Genesis 9, 5, and 6 comes in. The state is meant to defend those. Why? Because it's meant to defend the image. Those are the social expressions of the image. And so we will not be surprised, hopefully, when we come to the law later on in Exodus and Deuteronomy, and we start to see civil laws that treat these institutions in that way. Because man is made in the image of God. Now, notice that the idea of protection runs both ways. The state exists to protect the image of God in its individual and in its communal dimensions. It is meant to defend life, liberty, and property, but it is also meant to defend the family, education, and labor by extension. Because if you don't defend a family, you're not defending life. That's where they are. That's where they come from. It means the same thing in a society. If you're not defending education, which we're going to define this biblically, in other words, the parents are passing on to their children the conditions of staying free, of exercising their will for God. If you don't defend that liberty, you're not defending life. We saw that last week, that slope. If you attack property, you attack liberty. If you get rid of liberty, you get rid of life. So see last week's notes how that works. On the other hand, these institutions have been designed by God as a kind of buffer between the individual and the state. And as we're going to see in the fall, there's a totalizing tendency of the state. So if these institutions go, it's because the state has already asserted itself as in the place of all those things. In other words, as God. I have a couple of other things about answering an objection on a use of force in general. My argument is basically that when you look in the Bible, you will any prohibition to using force is only a prohibition against vengeance, Romans 12, or the vindication of one's own private offense, Matthew 5, 39, and 40. In other words, in both prohibitions, the same principle is there. God does not place my enemies in a private covenant with me as the head to determine who gets to live and who gets to die, who gets to give me my property back and so on. In the gospel, we are to give up those things in the individual. So, for example, Jesus says, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, offer him also the other. He does not say, if somebody abuses one of your sisters, offer him also the other. Do you see the difference? By the way, notice at the end of Revelation that one of the people that will be out with the dogs and not inherit the kingdom are cowards. Have you ever noticed that? Cowardice is treated as a defining mark of reprobation. Okay? So just go home and think about that for a second. He strikes you on the right cheek, offer him also the other. There's a private offense there. Me as an end of myself. As opposed to the idea how silly it would be, and why would it be morally silly? Why would it be idolatrous to hear, if someone violates one of your sisters, offer him also the other? What's the difference? Okay, so be thinking about that. I have a good quote by D.A. Carson on the whole coin. We'll come back to the coin, though. What is Caesar's and what is Christ? We'll come back to that in a later week. That's just extra stuff for you. Further reading for you, just a little introduction to what Kuyper meant by sphere sovereignty, all that good stuff. So, let me open up to questions or comments or anything else.